Hello and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rao.
Andy, we are recording this the day that it's coming out. So if that gives you any indication about how things are going over here in Roll for Topic land, there you go.
But yeah, it's all under control, everyone. Don't worry.
It's all under control. We just the Roll for Topic Con is happening in 8 days, I guess. 8 days from now.
No, it's at least a couple months out.
No, yeah, unfortunately, yeah, it's coming up soon. No, 9 days. Yeah. So anyway, we are kind of hard at work doing that in the background, kind of recording slipped a little bit, but we are happy to be here to chit chat for just a little bit.
We are indeed. Yeah. And Chris, I know it couldn't have been that long ago that we recorded the last episode, but I feel like we haven't chatted in a while.
Yes. We've both been so busy with doing other stuff that I don't think we've gotten a chance to check in. So you mentioned to me that you had a couple things that you wanted to bring up. Why don't we start with this?
Yeah, I just had a couple things I thought we could chat about. We can just keep this one kind of breezy and lightweight. Mm-hmm. My first question is, I know that this probably has not entered your mind yet, but have you given any thought to running a game for Halloween this year?
Oh my goodness, yes. Have I given any thought to it? No, but I mean, as soon as you said, like, you started that question, I was like, oh, I gotta do something for Halloween. Yeah, it's people who've listened to this podcast or know me, like, you know, I do really like running kind of like holiday themed games, and I, you know, I've done stuff for like, you know, a handful of Halloweens in the past few years. So I don't know. I mean, I need to think about it. I feel like this year could be a fun one to try to run one for, maybe, like, I've got an 11-year-old, maybe her and her friends.
Yeah.
It could be a really good one too. Especially if I can find like a way to do it like themed, maybe around their costumes that they're already doing.
Oh, so, man. Yeah.
Yeah, so I need to give that some more thought, but that's kind of my first thought, and I think that might be actually a really fun thought.
That is a really good age.
Yeah.
Your kids will have fun with whatever they're doing with their friends around the table. So yeah, in the past you have run, I've been kind of jealous, you've run some kind of interesting or experimental games from time to time. Mm-hmm. The one I think about is, didn't you do like a bonfire outside, you all sat around and you played, was it Lasers and Feelings?
Yeah, that one was, this was years ago, so that was a Lasers and Feelings hack that I did. The setting for that was that they were all actors from a like a 90s like family sitcom.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like a in-universe kind of special episode for that sitcom. So we did that outside. That was during the kind of the COVID years, right? So it was like, I wasn't super comfortable for various reasons to meet inside.
Yeah.
At that point. So we just did it outside around a bonfire, and that ended up being like a really fun setting, to do a game, especially, yeah, like kind of a nice fall, you know, Midwestern, fall day. Yeah. It was really great. But I can definitely recommend running a game like that. It was also nice to, like, I think we've talked about it before, there's this concept of like TTRPGs, like you have to sit around a table to play them. But like, whenever you can kind of break out of that, I think it's really nice. Like, there's no reason other than it can be hard to write if you don't have a table in front of you. But like, I mean, yeah, if you have a game that doesn't really rely on like needing to have character sheets and books and stuff out like that, like just sit around a campfire, sit around, I don't know, like in your living room, like, yeah, kind of break out of the, like, we have to sit down, like it's a formal meeting. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you've like tucked away over the last year where you're like, this would be a cool game to run on like Halloween specifically, or just like sometime when I need an excuse to just run something a little out of the ordinary that's a one shot?
Yeah, you know, I was looking at my stack of games. So, like, one thing that we do at Roll for Topicon is we have this thing called the swap table. So this is where everybody kind of brings their games that they are not going to play and puts them on the table, and then you can pick up stuff that you have convinced yourself that you are absolutely going to play. If you grab it for free from the swap table. So I was looking through everything, and I ran across my copy of Brindlewood Bay. And and that is a game that like I've played a couple times and I really like. I run it once at the con and really enjoyed. And like that has a, you could definitely make that Halloween-y, if you will. And it's just, it's a fun system. It's just a super, super fun system. Yeah. And like that one is not going on the swap table. It's like every time I touch it, I'm like, oh, I just really want to, want to play more. Yeah. In this one. So that might be a good one to do. I mean, I'm sure I could find, I could write a scenario for that pretty easily if I did this thing like with my kids and like their, my kids and their friends and their costumes. We could easily kind of adapt that, that system to do something, you know, like, you know, case of the missing candy or whatever, you know,
it's like, yeah. I mean, like a lot of games of that stripe, it's very easy to reskin and keep the mechanical bones intact, which is great. Yeah. So
are you thinking of anything for Halloween? Do you?
I am. So the last couple of years I have run, probably most of the last 5 years I've run Alien for one group or another. And I wouldn't mind doing Alien again, but I also probably have mined out, you know, what the Alien universe has to offer. Maybe. Yeah. But for the same reason I will happily watch Alien or Aliens anytime, even though I've seen them a bunch, I'll run Alien. Yeah. No, but this time I have been reading some literature that falls into the gothic category, which is a little new for me, and I've been digging it. Yeah. And so I have been percolating it in my mind as just a fairly traditional ruined gothic castle that you need to explore. So I've been kind of having some fun just thinking about like what that castle might be like and who's the tragic, you know, villain that you encounter in it and all of that good stuff.
Would you do, would it be a vampire? Would you go that route? Or are you thinking?
I would be fine with it being a vampire. I think this is a genre we're leaning into the cliches rather than trying to shake them up is probably the way to go. You know, a tragic Strahd or Dracula like vampire. Totally. If I could, since I'll be running it in, you know, like a fantasy system, if I could come up with like maybe a, another type of villain that could be a tragic villain that isn't a vampire, I guess I wouldn't mind. So I've been like you don't see mummies used a lot. Is a mummy like an interesting, you know? And so my mind has been bouncing around to a few different offerings. If you have suggestions, you know, or something you've always felt is like underused but has great dramatic potential as a villain, I'm all ears.
Yeah, I mean, mummies is a really good one. Because it's, I was thinking, like mummies, you got like what, Frankenstein, which is sort of mummy adjacent in a certain way. Yeah, vampires. I mean, I think, you are right. Like the tropes are the fun part about that genre. So I think like, leading into it, you could always go like, I don't know, like is it Dorian Gray, right? Like kind of like that.
Yeah.
That might be a fun thing to play with.
Oh, too. Interesting. Yeah.
Can I ask, this is a very much a tangential question, but this is something I've been meaning to ask you because it came up. My wife and I were talking and she asked the question. This is a vampire lore question. When vampires bite you, do they like they bite you on the neck and then there, you know, there's the two holes there.
Yeah.
Are there long teeth that they bite you with? Are those sort of like straws that they then suck through? Or do they bite you and then drink your blood as it's flowing? And I am wondering if you have if like any of your kind of experience with the Vampire the Masquerade or anything like that has a definitive answer about that.
You know what? I read too many Anne Rice novels last year, and I could tell you a lot of dumb stuff about vampires, but I can't answer that question. What does your heart tell you is probably the answer.
My heart tells me that they're not straws, but I do find it fascinating that like, despite how much the core part of like being a vampire is the like drinking the blood, that like no one has the quick, easy answer of like, oh, well, this is the mechanic of it. So
yeah, interesting. If I were being forced to pick, I think I would say that they are not straws, that they are just tools to open up a wound in the neck, which the vampire then drinks out of. That's my sense.
Maybe this is the hook for your gothic campaign, is you have a bunch of people, like a bunch of scientists who like need to figure this out.
They've
heard that there's a vampire.
We'll pay you 50 gold pieces if you can prove that I'm right and my academic rival is wrong about vampire physiology.
That's really great. I mean, it could be a whole thing. It's like, you know, there's a rumor that there was this vampire that was killed in this castle. Right, you know, this castle, so you gotta go into the ruins to like go find like the body that was buried underneath whatever,
right? Yes,
and, like, so you get in there and then you find out that it's not actually dead.
Oh, that's fun. Okay, I am certainly going to do something with like the you're going in there to find the answer to some academic question. Yeah. I think I need to do that.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, that's cool. I'll keep you posted. You know, closer to the date, I'm sure we'll chat Halloween games more, because we chat about that every year, basically. So,
I mean, it is. I'm glad you called it out, because so we've got this episode, and then we've got the con, and then usually after the con, we publish an episode that we recorded at the con. So it's very quickly going to be October before the next time that we.
It is.
What are the gothic books that you've been reading, the novels you've been reading?
Yeah, so I just finished a wonderful book called The Manuscript Found in Saragossa by a Polish author from the 18th century. His name is Count Jan Potocki, if that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
It's a sort of Arabian Nights sort of a sequence of nested stories nested within each other, and a lot of them have a heavy foot in the Gothic genre. And then since I read that, I did get pretty interested in this. I've picked up another book, which is right over here. I've only just started it. I just started reading Melmoth the Wanderer by Charles Maturin. Again, I might be mispronouncing that.
Yeah.
I think this is a pretty famous Gothic novel. So I don't know. Yeah, I've been soaking in it. I really enjoy, it turns out I really enjoy this kind of melodramatic prose. And yeah, it just got me thinking how I can like leverage it for an RPG.
Nice. So. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so my second question for you, Chris, is related to this Halloween game question, because I'm looking at what systems to use. And I've kind of narrowed down that if I play with one particular group of player, I'm just going to use Savage Worlds, which I know is pretty traditional. If it's a different particular group, I'm going to use Trophy Gold to run it.
Ooh, okay.
Trophy is one of these games. I decided to do it because while I was going through my bookshelves, like as we discussed an episode or two ago, and trying to trim them down, this is a game that's been on my bookshelf that I've like read through. I admire it in principle, but I've never run it, and I have this feeling like if I'm not going to run it, maybe it needs to go on the swap table, or maybe I'm gonna. But so here's my question. So Trophy Gold is one is another game that is a descendant of Powered by the Apocalypse and Forged in the Dark and other games that swim in that pool of sort of narrative-y fiction first type of games. And I am anticipating a problem, assuming I run Trophy Gold, I am anticipating a problem that I have run into and never really figured out with the various Blades games. And that is what I have seen some people call it, like creativity overload or overwhelm, or or I think of it as like consequence overwhelm.
Yeah.
And that is like, so these systems have parts of the mechanics where you roll the dice to see what happened, but instead of finding out exactly what happened, you get some variant of like make something up. In like the Blades type game specifically, and Trophy does this too, it's actually I think mathematically more likely that you will get a result that is you succeeded with a consequence that you need to make up, or you failed with a consequence that you need to make up. And and they also Trophy, like Blades, has a mechanic of like the Devil's Bargain where you can kind of pitch some sort of consequence in order to get yourself a mechanical advantage. That is great. I love that. It's one of the things that I find delightful about that whole strain of role-playing games. Here's the big but. But when I have run these, I usually find myself kind of hating the system by about like halfway through the game system.
Yeah.
And that is because in a game system that doesn't have a ton of mechanical, easy mechanical levers, it is hard to come up with a consequence on the fly. If you're running Pathfinder or Savage Worlds or D&D and you don't have the creativity to come up with like, it's the seventh consequence someone rolled in this sequence, in this same scene, and you have no more ideas. In those games, you can be like, all right, whatever. You're at a minus two for your next roll, or you have disadvantage for your next roll, or something like those. There's some like easy, low stakes mechanical consequences you can toss at players in those situations. But in a game like Trophy or Blades, the only mechanical levers you can pull are pretty big ones. Like you get an extra die or you lose a die, you know, things that pretty mechanically, they're pretty big deals. Mm-hmm. So this is my long-winded way of asking you, what practical things have you done or can you think of where I know going in, like, that this is going to happen, and by the fifth consequence, I'll be out of ideas for consequences. What do you do to prep for this? And let's assume, for the sake of this discussion, I know you can, I could just ignore this rule, right? I could just stop it. But, like, let's say I want to keep engaging with the system. So either what am I doing wrong that I keep having to come up with consequences, or B, like, and how do I come up with those consequences? Have you had the, first I'll ask, have you had this, been in this situation?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That fatigue is very real when you're running these sorts of games, because it does demand more of you than, oh, you missed. Okay. On to the next person, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you missed. And now you, I don't know, broke your arm, or you fell off the thing you were doing, or they noticed that you're, you're coming in, all that sort of stuff. I think the thing that I have learned, and we played Blades in the Dark like years ago, like it used you and me, we just did like a quick one shot one time.
Yeah. In thinking through this problem, I thought specifically of that game because this problem was very evident in that game.
Yeah, super evident. I think I even did a write up of that. I should see. I don't know if I published that anywhere.
Oh, but I don't remember that, but I'd love to read it.
Yeah, but my main takeaway from that was, like, I really liked doing that one shot, and it was a really good way to sort of like test out the system and sort of see what we liked from it. The thing that I didn't like was that I asked you to roll way too many times. Mm-hmm. Right. And I've since played, you know, Blades in the Dark, like, both as a player and, you know, run it as a GM, and, like, yeah, played other games like this before. I think the your inclination when you're running those games, because there's so much like fun mechanical, like, kind of complexity, and like there's rules and stuff about the role, is that you want to roll like a lot. You're just like, okay, well, let's figure out, like, you know, different ways to kind of like introduce this thing back to the table, because, like, this is the core part of the rules, right? That can be a mistake, because then I think then it can lead to, like, okay, well, we're fighting, so now I need to resolve combat using this mechanic, but I also want combat to kind of feel as crunchy as like D&D, right? So you're like kind of trading blows back and forth. So, like, when I've done this poorly, right, it's like, oh, okay, like, so it's sort of your turn, like, you know swing, you take one, you do one hit point of damage, right? You know, like, and you're kind of like, you like, if you're trying to simulate the whole fight, like, you can end up doing too many die rolls in there, and then you're coming up with way too many consequences, where I think the better way to maybe do this is to, like, you just reduce, especially if it's just a fight against some like low level goons or whatever, it just all gets reduced down to a single die roll, right? So then it's, rather than it being like a, like, you punch, like, let's roll a die, you kick, let's roll, you know, do another roll for that, like, you throw a chair, let's do another roll for that. It's just sort of one roll for like the fight itself, right? And then it's more, and I think if you start thinking in those terms, it becomes less fatiguing, because then it's more clear. It's like, oh, like, you decided to fight this guy, like, and you succeeded, so, like, okay, like, you punch him and he gets knocked out, right? Like, or you decide to fight this guy, you punch him, it doesn't knock him out, he punches you really hard, you break your arm and he runs off, right? Like, you kind of condense the fight into like one roll, so then every time you're coming up with consequences, it's less of this like slog of like the same sort of action is keeps on happening, so I got to come up with like kind of new ways to make this action happen. And it's more like, oh, this like scene happened, or like this like small, like this, yeah, this, like, I don't know, yeah, this kind of, the scene happened, what happens with that scene, and then we're sort of on to the next thing.
Interesting. So it's more like a, yeah, it's, you know, it's not hard to come up like one or two consequences that could manifest in a scene.
Yeah, yeah.
It is very hard to come up with like a lot of consequences that manifest on a round to round basis, I guess you might say. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's what I think. I've also played in a game of 7th Sea, like a long campaign of 7th Sea, and like there was a similar thing that happened there of like, yeah, because combat like had some crunch and back and forth to it. But like, you know, like, so the GM, you know, my GM Matt, like, you know, he did a great job with this, but it's just like, at a certain point, you're like, I don't want to come up with another thing that can happen. Mm-hmm. This kind of like this, you know, blow by blow thing. Yeah. So I think like when you're running those games, like you have to take a step back and like, it's interesting because like you're telling a story together, but like, you know, and it still might have the same complexity as like a, I don't know, like a story in your D&D, or probably actually more complexity. Right. But like you want to roll as little as possible almost for that, and make the rolls feel like a lot more important, Right. Yeah. Cause then too, it's like, if you know you're reducing the roll for like a whole fight down to, you know, one or two rolls, then I think all the negotiation stuff becomes a lot more interesting. Cause then you're having the conversation about like the devil's bargain then truly is like more interesting at that point. Mm. It's like, yes, you can do this, but you know, like the person they've kidnapped is going to get executed or whatever. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, yeah, so you might get the extra die, and like the result of that could be that you save yourself, but like you lose that person, right? Versus like, give me a devil's bargain, like I want to hit him really hard, and if you know, like, and it will break my hand no matter what, right? But I'm still gonna have to hit him again, right? And like, yeah, hit him again to get like his hit points down. So that can reduce the fatigue a little bit. I do also think that these games, you need to like rely on your players to help you come up with the consequences too, or just run shorter sessions, because it's just like the reality is like it is mentally taxing to run them. Yeah. I think right, and like especially if you want, and a desire of yours is to have all those consequences feel unique and tailored to the situation, it's just going to be too much for you to run like a 4-hour long game.
I have a lot of thoughts.
Yeah.
First of all, do you like rolling less but the stakes are higher, or do you like rolling constantly but the stakes of any given die roll are pretty low?
I personally have come to appreciate having the stakes be really high for a die roll, right? And in that it feels much more like a gated decision. I think that's where you get more interesting role playing happening, because it does feel weighty, right, in a way that like a single round of a D&D combat doesn't feel weighty. So like that's sort of what I've come down on. I think like, you know, earlier on, it was more important to me to have like everything kind of be simulated by the die. But like I think there's just some stuff. It's like, yeah, it's like the classic thing of like, I don't know, like your D&D party's trying to jump over a river or like, or climb a wall or something. Like if you keep on like having them roll for every little thing, like, you know, and someone fails, and then it's just like, it's not interesting. Cause like, you're like, well, okay, like I'm just going to try again, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. That's
like
a good example. We have all been in a D&D game where it's like the third person is now has to make 3 athletics checks to get across the gorge. And it's like, what are we even doing? Like, just put us on the other side of the gorge.
Yeah, but put us on the other side. Like we can make it, or like, yeah, I don't know. Give us like a small, I don't know, like you roll and like, yeah, you made it across the gorge, but like you, I don't know, bumped your knee on something or whatever, like, you know, take 2 hit points off, you know? Yeah. Like I think there's just different ways of kind of like speeding that along to kind of get the same results without getting too bogged down in additional die rolls.
Yeah. This, I sometimes think that this is one of the hardest hobby shifts for me personally to have wrapped my head around. Cause I grew up playing like pretty simulationist systems, have a lot of fondness for that type of game. And, you know, in those games, you just roll all the time, right? Like you roll dice for little stuff. You roll dice when you just need a second to like figure out what you want to do next as GM. You just give somebody a skill check to make, and then you use that as a little guide. And I remember probably a couple of years ago, we probably talked about this on the show, like the first time or two I ran Alien, the first edition of Alien, that was like the first game where I was like, I'm going to have to change my mindset around this fundamental part of role playing, rolling dice, because in at least the first edition of Alien, the every time you're rolling the dice, pretty much you are risking adding like panic to your character.
Yeah,
and the game, it gets very stupid very quickly if you're like having people, okay, like roll to see if you can pick the lock on the door, roll to see if you can, you know, whatever, if you can turn the lever to turn on the engine, you know, if you do that, like D&D, sure, give me a strength check all the time. Then like your character in Alien, at least your characters are like piling up the stress that is supposed to like kick in when a monster appears and jumps out of someone's chest. Right. Like, so it's something I recognize, but I just feel like it feels good to me to be like, to throw out like a, I'm not sure. Why don't you roll the dice and let's see what happens? That feels good to me. That said, I also, there is no feeling like people in like a Blades game spending like 15 minutes wringing every mechanical advantage they can for a single die roll that is going to be a life or death plot shaking die roll. That is a special kind of excitement that I love. So, but it's hard to remember to do that at the table, I guess.
Yeah. I almost wonder if a way to approach it for you might be like giving yourselves a little tally, right? Give yourself a clock of like, you know, you only want to do six die rolls throughout the evening or something like that, or like whatever, you know, kind of define that ahead of time of like what feels like a good cadence there of like, okay, like, you know, we want to tell this story. Everybody has their character. I sort of want to hit these plot beats, and it's like, and through that, we want to make sure that there's whatever 6 to 10 like moments where it feels like it really matters to roll the die, right? So it's you're not rolling for like, I don't know, can I pick the lock on that door? Because you already know how to pick a lock, but like, yeah, you're gonna roll for like, I don't know, whatever, trying to talk the vampire down or
right. Yeah. By the way, I love the idea that as the GM, I have a little pouch of 15 D6s.
Ooh.
And then when those are the dice I get to use all night.
That's fascinating.
I mean, I don't know if I could do that. I mean, there are some systems, I think like Daggerheart, and there's a couple other systems that like kind of center the players as the drivers of initiative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they sort of gate the GM's ability to step in and roll dice behind what the players are doing.
Yes, yeah.
I feel like I always feel wary of those systems, but kind of intrigued by them at the same time. When you played Daggerheart, did that come into play? Did it feel like the GM was only stepping in at like weighty moments that had been triggered by stuff you did? Or did it play out mostly like a regular D&D type?
It mostly played out like a regular D&D type. I mean, it was a pretty friendly table of like people who played a ton of games too. So like, you know, part of that was just, you know, we knew how to sort of navigate a system in a way that felt fair to everybody. Yeah, I think I've got mixed feelings. I think there's a lot of fun, like your idea of like you've just got a bag full of, you know, 20 die like D6s or something, and like when they're gone. Like that is incredible. Like I really like that idea, but like that kind of the conversation, like the kind of the push pull of like, oh, I failed this roll, so now you get whatever three, you know, now the GM gets three extra dice or like whatever you call them,
right,
in the system to use against you. Like that can feel fun. It also, I think, just sets up this kind of antagonistic relationship between the players and the GM, whereas I generally like to play games where it feels like it's a collaborative storytelling experience, right? So like,
you know,
Blades, I think at its best is the GM is really just kind of playing the world in a way. And it's like, you know, everybody's playing their players, you know, their characters, and then the GM's playing the world, but everybody's collaborating with each other to kind of figure that out. And like, again, and throwing out consequences that make sense for them too.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Like there's no reason those consequences can't come from your players other than it feels different.
Yeah. I remember I've run a modest amount of the Star Trek, the most recent Star Trek RPG, and it has a system where, like a lot of games, like when the players do cool stuff, they hand the GM like a token or a die or a poker chip or something like that, and that goes into the GM's pool to do like awful stuff to the PCs. Then that creates, and I had this thought running Star Trek at the time, What I found sometimes is that players would like not do cool stuff because they saw that token going onto the GM pile.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean it does create a nice rhythm or whatever, but only if everybody is like totally in sync with each other on like the feel of what they want. I guess we've drifted away from this, but this has been helpful.
Yeah.
On a super practical level, and we can wrap this up because we've been chatting for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Do you write down consequences before a game? Like, would you ever make a list of like 20 just understanding you won't know exactly what the situations are? Like, would you ever make yourself a list of like 20 things that could go wrong in a social scene? 20, you know, would that be helpful to you or not really?
You know, I think it would be helpful, but I don't know if I'd ever do it. Like, it's like, I think for me, part of the fun is coming up with stuff somewhat on the fly. I will sketch out like, you know, larger, it's like if there's a set piece in the story that we're telling where it's like this could kind of go one of either, you know, one of two ways, like I'll kind of sketch that out, or you're like, here's a quick idea for a plan B. But yeah, I think having some of that, I mean, right, like you have a list of NPC names for a reason, right? So you don't have to try to come up with it on the spot. Like there's no reason to not have that, right? Especially if it's like, you know, you have one for combat, you have one for social situations, you have one for, like, I don't know, whatever, athletics checks, right? You could just kind of do it based on the move sets that they have as well.
Yeah.
Just to get, like, spark something in you, right? You're going to modify it, but, like, yeah, just to have it sort of ready at hand.
We often mention Indiana Jones as like the king of that type of action sequence where, like, it's constant consequences that make it all more fun. Like, I think of that. So, like, you know that scene in the first Indiana Jones movie where he's on that, they're trying to get in that German, like, flying wing airplane. And I think of that from, like, a role-playing perspective. Like, that scene has a lot of consequences that come up as the action plays out. But, like, what that scene was, like, set up with a bunch of stuff that could easily just be toppled over, right, by a GM. It's not like the GM planned, this is what's going to happen. It's more like, here's, like, five just things that could introduce chaos to the scene. So in that scene, whatever, they're trying to get in, but the GM set up a bunch of gas cans off on the side, right?
Yes, yeah.
And the GM set that the whole plane is only being held still by some little, like, blocks that could be kicked out, right?
Yeah.
And there's probably a super burly guard within range, you know? Mm-hmm. And that scene has the feeling of, like, that you don't have to panic to come up with that stuff because you just put a bunch of, like, easy things that you could topple into the scene, I guess.
Yeah, that's a really good way of thinking about it too. Yeah, rather than trying to come up with the consequences, just come up with enough stuff to sort of, like, fill the scene.
There's enough Legos in the room that you can quickly put to, I'm not sure if that metaphor works. But
yeah, probably not. I mean, the true Lego fans are being like, it's not Legos, it's Lego. You've already lost them.
Oh, I want you to know, when I said that, I did say Legos, but I did say it in all caps.
So, okay, good. Yeah, that's good. So. Yeah.
All right, well, Chris, we should wrap up. Do you have any final thoughts either on Halloween game, or do you have any like hot take tips for me as I plan possibly consequence heavy delve into a gothic castle?
Oh, I mean, I think Trophy Dark is probably the perfect, the perfect system for this. As long as you got player buy-in, I think it's a really good.
It'll be Trophy Gold if it's one configuration of players, and Trophy Dark if it's a different one.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Same system. One is like a a death spiral, and the other is not. So we'll just see how it goes.
You have to flip a coin right before you start.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that sounds really good. I think that is a super good setup for a very fun Halloween game.
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
All right.
Well, let's see. That does it for us. You can go listen to Andy on Zombie Strains with John Corey. I believe they just recently did a modern movie, right? Did you go and watch a modern movie, or does that just...
Oh, yes, we did. We watched A Colony, which is the latest zombie movie by a Korean director who I think you would have to say he's one of the top zombie directors alive right now, making zombie movies.
Yeah, he did Train to Busan, right?
And Peninsula, and then this one, Colony.
Wow, okay. Yeah, I saw Train to Busan, and I remember really liking it quite a bit.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm also watching a Korean, I guess, I struggle to come up with the right terminology for it. It's a survival reality TV show. It's competition reality TV show. I've been watching along with Matt, my GM and friend. He's also been watching it. So it's this show called Game of Blood. It has my GM brain spinning, although I can't really, like, I can't coalesce any of the thoughts other than, like, wow, there's a lot you can do with that format of a reality TV show that, like, the US is just not doing anything with.
So I also watched, at Matt's suggestion, I watched with Matt it was one of these Korean reality shows, and it was a zombie survival scenario. Yeah. And they are doing such more interesting stuff with I have no interest in American style reality TV where a bunch of, like, hot bachelors and ladies are on an island. Like, I just have no interest in that. But, like, why aren't we doing cooler stuff? Because the Korean market is doing it. Like, why aren't we copying them? So I don't know. Maybe in the next year or two. I do feel like Korean pop culture is, like, on a global surge right now. So it wouldn't shock me if we start seeing some American knockoffs of these shows.
There's all sorts of interesting cultural reasons for that too. But I would hope that we'd start seeing more knockoffs. Anyway.
But you're right. It's like it's pure GM like over idea fuel overload, yes. even if you can't figure out quite what to do with it.
Yeah. It is just like, I mean, this show, like, I mean, you know, the episodes are each like an hour and a half long, right? Like, you know, and they just feel like these huge expansive things. There's just like, I mean, talk about like, you know, giving a bunch of Lego to your players. There's just right. all sorts of different things they can interact with. And it just keeps creating these like very surprising interactions. I mean, surprising to me, like for all I know, like there's this genre is more expansive than what I know, but it's really good. So if you are for some reason looking for a TV show in your life and you are open to watching a dubbed Korean show, Game of Blood, I can highly recommend.
It's totally worth it. Even if you think you're not like the person who would enjoy it, I promise you would. Yeah. Last question before we sign off, Chris, you did use the term Lego correctly in that sentence.
Yeah.
Did that make you feel like a corporate sellout? Because that's how it makes me feel. Like I actively resent that Lego wants me to refer to their brand by their by the correct name. That might be a problem with me though.
No, that's like this is a problem of I hang out with too many programmers. So exactness can be a thing that is both required to talk to them and also like I don't know, just being pedantic is sort of like in the culture of it as
What's
well.
What's the Simpsons technically correct? The best kind of correct?
Yes,
or something.
You know what? I'm not even gonna correct you. Let's just leave it at that.
That was bait for some Simpsons fans that I know listen to this, by the way.
I hope cannot wait until you're just gonna get absolutely eviscerated in the comments.
Awesome.
Cool. All right. Well, I think that does it for us. I've been Chris Salzman.
I've been Andy Rao.
Remember, if your player's having fun, you're a great GM.